It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Democratic candidate for governor Mary Burke released her jobs plan this morning. We'll talk to two reporters and a political scientist about the specifics of the plan and how it might play out in the election this fall.
It's hard to distill 3,000 years of history into a single story, but that's what our guest now has done, taking a look at the cultural and historical pieces, big and small, that together describe a part of the Jewish experience.
The history of the Jewish people spans over three millennia. It includes slavery, genocide, mass migrations, and exiles. Throughout these various forms of persecution, the Jewish religion still survives and the people still thrive across different distant parts of the globe.
In his new book and documentary series, Simon Shama says that endurance may actually be what it means to be a Jew, an ability to overcome and to thrive.
The documentary is called The Story of the Jews. It premieres tonight at 7 on your local PBS station. Simon Shama, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's fine being here.
You begin your series by asking what a Jew is, and there isn't an obvious answer. How do you tackle that question?
No, it isn't an obvious answer, really, because actually, you know, as I say, Jews look quite differently, every color of skin, every imaginable accent. But what I say binds Jews together is their sense of belonging to the same story, and also an extremely strong sense that through words, through the story, survival has actually happened. The Jewish experience is not, I think, unique in terms of what a persecuted people has to go through, but it is rather special in terms of being able to survive when the usual things that help you endure, an army, political institution, territory, is taken away from you, and you simply use portable writing. That's what happened with the Jews in several centuries, even before the Bible was finished, and you know, it's how we've managed to cohere over the centuries.
Writing this history is a project that you basically put off for decades. What made you embrace it now?
Precisely the introduction. It is completely impossible to actually do a television series in 5 hours about the entirety of Jewish history. But I don't know. I just thought the time now, there is so much misunderstanding. Anti-Semitism is on the rise. It turns out that other than the destruction of the planet, the single most intractable problem we have in the world right now is how do peoples of different beliefs share the same living space without the obligation to oppress or even kill each other. And the Jews have a very particular story to tell to non-Jews as well, I think. It's an outward story very often. That's to say, Jewish history has never really been separate from non-Jewish history. Jews have never even lived separately unless they've been forced to live separately. And there are all kinds of resonances, I think, for our perplexities and dilemmas in the modern world that I wanted to try and explain and tell that particular story.
And you don't just tell the story of persecution and exile. You also try to just tell the stories of some of the people as far back as you can go, given the historical record, given the stories of the stories that have been passed down. Who are some of the first people we meet in the earliest recorded history?
Well, that's a tricky thing, because actually the meeting point of the Bible is not reliable history. The Bible is, you know, certainly the story of the Exodus. There's no archaeological evidence for it. Excitingly, as we explore in the first program, recent excavation seems to have shown that there was a kind of mini Judean state based on Jerusalem, presumably ruled over by King David. We know King David did actually exist from a stone inscription from the 9th century BC found in the northern Israeli town of Dan. So, you know, David is a kind of ghostly presence in some way, but there he is in this imposing citadel fortress on the boundary of where Judeans and Philistines are supposed to have fought a battle. But, you know, the great figure in the Jewish Bible is invisible, faceless, formless, the personality of the unpredictable and always difficult Jewish God. And he's actually there through emptiness. There is extraordinary stone, tiny little model shrines that were also found on the same site, a place called Kibbet Kiafa. And they're very beautifully fashioned on the outside. But inside, instead of having animal gods or the images of pagan deities, there is simply dark, echoing emptiness. And it's from that emptiness that the beautiful words of the biblical faith were fashioned.
One of the things that excited you about taking on this project, I gather, was new historical artifacts, new sources that had come to light or maybe were newly understood. Yeah. Could you tell us about some of those?
Well, there is one thing that, you know, about the Jewish obsession with words is that it sounds as though it's meant for your program and would be great radio. But actually what's been uncovered increasingly over the last few decades are the place of images, of mosaic images particularly, in the history of the early synagogues. And this always comes as a shock to Jews and non-Jews who think that the second commandment, thou shalt not have graven images, meant to kind of ban on all images, particularly in synagogues themselves. But we know now from archaeological evidence this was not so. For the first 500 years, synagogue after synagogue, some have even been discovered with vibrant wall paintings, and not just of abstract patterns and animals and beasts, but actually pictures of people. In the case of one extraordinary Syrian synagogue, which I deal with in a book, we alas couldn't film because of the Syrian civil war, there are portraits of biblical figures of Moses and David and Solomon and Samuel. And this is a really drastic revision, one of the many drastic revisions to the way we think about the first synagogues after the destruction of the temple. For all you women out there, there is absolutely no evidence of any kind of separation of the sexes in the first half millennium of synagogue life.
That's something that's going to be controversial to some people, as are, I'm sure, other elements
already,
of telling
really
the story.
I've under the excommunication, I think, actually. And no, I've been, you know, struck off the gefilte fish list, I think, actually. So it's just too bad.
Well, is this a hard story to tell? Because within the Jewish community, I'm sure there's a lot of disagreement over basic questions of history and identity, and among Jews and non-Jews.
Surely you chaff.
I think I understate.
No, I describe very often communication among Jews as agreed mutual interruptions. And we thrive, really, by endless arguments and a lot of kind of mutual shouting. Even in we're about to have Passover, and all my Jewish friends out there will be going to Seder services, and we read from the storybook of the Passover, the Haggadah, and there are rabbis arguing furiously with each other over practically everything long into the night. So Judaism is a kind of, it's a religion, it's not a religion bound by obedience and authority, except to some of the core laws of the Torah, of the Bible. It's a religion which entertains and welcomes contradictions. The Talmud, which we show through, I think, extremely beautiful graphic, actually done by a Torah scribe and an animator, the Talmud has on any single page five different versions interpreting the same text. So, you know, we were kind of postmodern quarrelers before postmodernism was invented.
Simon, you write that the story of the Jews is really a story that you can't really pull out from the fabric of history as a whole. It's part of that whole.
Yeah.
How can we begin to think about it like that?
Well, I think actually Judaism doesn't really have a theology in the sense in which Christianity does, or possibly even Islam does. It does have a set of rules for living, and it has stories around how those rules were received and transmitted. But one thing it has, which was extraordinary and appears in the Bible early on, is the commandment to remember. And what you're remembering, really, is not just a set of the kind of moral precepts embodied in the Ten Commandments, but this extraordinary story of backsliding and impurity and disobedience and resistance, which is really all part of the human condition. So the Jewish God is a God who, at times, really walks among the mayhem that men create, and then he goes off in a huff and disappears only to return with dire punishments, or just turn his back, really, on his disobedient people. So it is, as you say, an extremely kind of fleshed out kind of religion. A lot of the gigantic coral reef of commentary, which is the Talmud, is wonderful to me because it's based on daily minutiae. I mean, one point in the Talmud, I couldn't quite believe what I was reading. Again, it's a Passover story. Two rabbis have discovered that one of the materials which is used to basically for waxing, I have to say, as a depilatory, to remove hair from the skin of gorgeous young Jewish princesses, was made partly of flour paste. This meant that it wasn't proper to use it during Passover, when we're not supposed to eat flour. Then these rabbis embark on this extraordinary sort of discussion of, well, you know, which is the best depilatory? How do they know? You know, really? Nevertheless, they can't stop talking about it. This is the Talmud.
Simon, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with historian Simon Shama. His documentary, The Story of the Jews, airs tonight at 7 on your local PBS station. Democratic candidate for Governor Mary Burke released her jobs plan this morning. She's calling it Invest for Success. Governor Scott Walker's campaign is saying this plan will stall economic recovery and take Wisconsin in the wrong direction. Here's a clip from the video the Burke campaign released with that plan.
Now I'm running for governor to create more good-paying jobs so we can grow and strengthen the middle class, because I know we can do a whole lot better than we've done under Scott Walker.
WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach was with Mary Burke this afternoon when she talked about her jobs plan at Marquette Law School. He's with us now to share those details. Chuck, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Mary Burke unveiled her new jobs plan this morning online, and she spoke about it this afternoon, as we said, and you were there. Can you sum up the key points of her plan for us?
Well, she sort of stresses five main points, and I'll try to sum them up as briefly as possible. One is to sort of promote industry clusters in the state, like the freshwater effort in Milwaukee going on. Another one is to boost the number of people with degrees, educational degrees. Also invest, boost capital investment in entrepreneurs, boost Wisconsin export efforts, and bringing some foreign manufacturing back to Wisconsin. And finally, what she calls creating a climate to grow jobs and a high-quality workforce, things like investing in infrastructure and improving the overall business climate. So those are the five main points.
Now, Governor Walker has responded to her plan already, saying it looks familiar and that Governor Walker already has the jump on a lot of those things she wants to do. And as for the rest of it, he's skeptical that it will work and could be detrimental for Wisconsin, he says. What did Burke have to say about his response?
Well, I don't know if she had exactly heard that, but the state Republican Party did attack her plan earlier in the day. You know, she says she's got some different ideas than the Walker administration has put into effect, that there would be, as I say, more efforts to, larger efforts to invest in businesses. There would be smarter efforts, less red tape, less confusion and problems at the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. The thing about the trying to get more investment in education through the higher education systems, institutions in the state, there's been suggestions that the Walker administration hasn't funded those as well as the Democrats would like. So there are some differences. She's spelling out some fairly significant differences to what's been taking place the last 4 years.
How much of this plan draws from Mary Burke's experience in the private sector with a Trek bicycle?
Well, she refers to that occasionally. Today she did. As she also mentioned, she had talked with some state business leaders in Milwaukee and elsewhere about putting together this 40-pager. The last few months she's been accumulating ideas from them. I'm not sure how many of their ideas went into this plan, but she says some of them did. She says that, as far as her term as Commerce Secretary in the Doyle administration, she says, and this is a point of some dispute, but she says she helped oversee a big expansion of jobs for a while there. And when she left the Doyle administration, the unemployment rate was down below 5%. Now, it grew quickly thereafterwards, but and whether that was economic, much larger economic forces at work, of course, is the issue.
Well, one of the key parts of her plan, it's centered on organizing economic development around industry clusters rather than, I gather, individual businesses. Could you break that down for us? What does that mean?
Well, sort of like I mentioned before, in Milwaukee, there's this freshwater effort. In other words, there's a number of businesses that rely on selling products to people who need clean water. And a number of them have gotten together since that Wisconsin's experience with abundant amounts of water, usually, Lake Michigan and inland lakes in rainfall and snow and so on, that we have some pretty good experience in making and selling products that take advantage of our knowledge in clean water and selling them to parts of the globe where water is harder to come by. And there are other industries as well. So the idea from Ms. Burke is to try and boost these, get them, bring together cluster leaders to a governor's leadership council to help steer development strategies fund cluster-based solutions. This cluster idea, of course, has been going on in other states as well. Burke says Wisconsin has some strengths that are underutilized.
And before I let you go, Chuck, do you have a sense of how the plan is going over so far?
Well, it's gotten some support from those left of center groups that are liking the. I mean, there are many components to the plan. One of them is to ease student loan burdens, and the lefty group was One Wisconsin Now has come out in favor of that. But again, the Republican Party, Governor Walker, trying to again tie Burke to Jim Doyle and suggesting that things are moving along in Wisconsin, jobs are being created, and what Burke is suggesting would take things backward. Burke says, in some more response to that, she says she would try to hold the line on taxes, that the way she would find money to pay for some of these things is go through the state budget a little more closely and find ways to save there.
All right, Chuck, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, WPR reporter Sean Johnson is with us in studio. He's been with Governor Walker today and has some of his reaction to Mary Burke's new jobs plan now. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, you've been traveling with Governor Walker today. What did he have to say about Mary Burke's new jobs plan?
Yeah, he spoke to reporters in a factory about 40 minutes north of Madison today, was asked specifically about Mary Burke's plan and the elements involving those business clusters you were talking about with Chuck, and about venture capital. And here's what the governor had to say.
Well, I think actions speak louder than words. We've been doing that with clusters, whether it's in manufacturing, agriculture, clean water technology, biosciences. Those are all things we focused on, not just individual employers. We've been doing that over the last 3 years. Beyond that, talking about venture capital, it's interesting that someone who's a part of administration where they didn't do that when she was the Secretary of Commerce is comparing it to. We've actually made the first significant investment in the venture capital, $25 million. We'll look to add more in the future.
And so I think, that you could hear that theme sort of echo in his remarks later on. Why weren't you doing this when you were Commerce Secretary? You were part of an administration that had a chance to do this. Why are you talking about it now?
And also Mary Burke, a marquee part of her plan seems to be those clusters, those business clusters that she was talking about. And Governor Walker saying, yeah, I got there first.
He is. And, I'm not sure how much the average person is spending time talking about business clusters. So it's going to be how either one of them sells it.
Well, his campaign has already come out to say that this plan is redundant. Governor Walker saying, as we said, he's addressed these ideas, some of these issues like the skills gap. Any other rebuttal that you heard to Mary Burke's plan?
He's trying to kind of frame her as a little bit of a flip-flopper right now. She came out earlier in the campaign, said she wasn't going to make any promises along the lines of what he did, with saying he was going to create 250,000 jobs in his first term. She's now at this event this afternoon, I gather, was talking about how she's going to try to position Wisconsin in the top 10 among job growth among the states. So it's a little bit of a promise there. Interestingly enough, the governor also today was talking about his famous 250,000 jobs pledge. He's now saying, it's okay if it happens a little bit after the end of my first term. I don't think it matters if it's a few months off. So, that it sounds like he might be a little bit flexible on that. I don't know how other people will feel about that.
So he's foreshadowing a little wiggle room for himself down the road.
Well, the economist that I talked to about this last week at Marquette University was saying it's probably mathematically impossible to hit that 250,000 number. And so now it becomes a matter of how he markets what he does have.
And in terms of one of the things, one of the most striking differences between Governor Walker and Mary Burke, her experience in the private sector, have you had a sense about how that particular difference will be played out, especially from the vantage point of Governor Walker during the race?
He hasn't. I mean, Republicans have kind of attacked her for Trek's experience with outsourcing some jobs overseas. You haven't heard the governor do that. I think the point she's going to be making as the counter to what the governor says to her is that I'm the one with private sector experience, and that the governor really has spent his career in government. And so you can kind of imagine that back and forth going on here. The governor seems to be viewing Mary Burke as somebody who's a commerce secretary under Jim Doyle, and pretty much any other experience is irrelevant as far as he's concerned, politically speaking.
Do you think that come election time, the big issue is going to be jobs? Is this what it's all going to be about?
It's probably been the big issue for the last several elections. I think, you know, regardless of what the numbers are or what people promise, it seems like people are going to vote based on how they feel and how they think things are going. And, you know, if they don't feel the things have turned around, then Mary Burke has a chance at winning here. If things are looking up, if people are feeling better, you know, races generally favor the incumbent.
Sean, thanks a lot for coming by.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Sean Johnson, WPR's state capitol reporter here on Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after the news, Mordecai Lee, government affairs professor at UW-Milwaukee, has been listening along. He'll have more analysis. And you can join the conversation about jobs in the governor's race at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation about jobs in the race for governor of Wisconsin. Mary Burke, the Democratic challenger, unveiled her jobs plan earlier today. The governor and his Republican allies responded.
We're turning to Mordecai Lee now as we continue our conversation about the new jobs plan just announced. Mordecai is a professor of governmental affairs at UW-Milwaukee. Mordecai, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, what is your initial reaction to Mary Burke's new plan announced today? It's called Invest for Success.
Well, as you'd expect of a professor, I believe in the power of ideas. And so I'm just really glad that she released the paper. I took a quick look at it. It's on the web for any of your audience to take a look at, just like people can access Scott Walker's campaign site and look at his economic proposals. I think elections should be about ideas. I don't think elections should be about who looks better on TV or who has better commercials. And, of course, economics are the top-tier issues for any campaign, given what's going on in America today. So every individual listener can read her plan, can read his plan, and can decide who they think ought to be governor for the next 4 years.
And we have a clip. There was a web component that she released today as well, talking about the job plan and some of the rationale behind it. And we're going to hear a clip from that in just a moment. But we also want to know what you think. Do you think these plans are this plan is a good idea for Wisconsin from Mary Burke? Why or why not? And how do you think the plan will come into play in the governor's race? You can call and let us know what you think at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. And now let's listen to a clip from Mary Burke.
Wisconsin has created jobs at just half the national average, and we're facing a growing income gap. These challenges didn't arrive overnight, but Walker's approach is making them worse. We need big, bold ideas to build a thriving top 10 economy and new leadership to make it happen.
And that's some of the preface for Mary Burke's new jobs plan unveiled today. Mordecai, she's talking about those ideas you were interested in. And is this going to be a war of ideas? Essentially, we're talking about jobs, the big driving issue in this upcoming race. But how important are these dueling ideas going to be?
I think they're central to the campaign. Unless things unfold in a way that the public can't differentiate between Scott Walker's economic platform and her economic platform, in which case the campaign might be about social issues like abortion and controversial issues like that. But it's pretty traditional, going back to when I was in politics in the 70s and 80s, that what we called bread and butter issues or lunch pail issues were the ones that people cared about, and people could see how it affected them. And so in a sense, the election campaign over the next couple of months is going to be a referendum on who the voters think can do a better job for the next 4 years, or sometimes sort of flipping it, if they want to give Governor Walker a good grade for what he's done in the last 4 years or a bad grade, who deserves to be governor for the next 4 years. You know, that's why we still hold elections, because it's so unpredictable.
Now, we just talked to our state government reporter, Sean Johnson, from Wisconsin Public Radio, and he was saying that it looks pretty impossible. Some economists are saying that Governor Walker will hit his stated jobs goal, 250,000 new jobs, and that he's going to sort of portray it as something that, you know, at least the state is moving in the right direction, and that's a positive thing, and that's what we need to talk about, not missing this mark of 250,000 jobs. Do you think that that will satisfy people, the fact that Governor Walker is saying, yeah, we are moving in a good direction?
Gosh, beats me, in the sense of it's so unpredictable what gets traction and what doesn't get traction with the voters. I think we're seeing what a skilled politician Scott Walker is in the sense that he confronts it head on. And Sean said that he raised it. He talked about the 250,000 promise. You know, will the election be about you didn't succeed in your promise and therefore you don't deserve re-election? Or will it be about the way you just described, Veronica? It was a stretch goal. It was a tough goal. You're making progress and you deserve another 4 years. And you know, what's so interesting about this election is that Mary Burke is sort of running as a kind of a standard-issue Democrat, and I think it's fair to say that Scott Walker is a standard-issue 2014 Republican. But here we've got a situation where she's talking about being a business person. We're so used to having the Republican candidate talk about being a business person in the way that Ron Johnson beat Senator Russ Feingold going back 4 years ago. So to me, it's wonderful to have this kind of election campaign going on for the next couple of months.
Yeah, that is a different dynamic that you just framed there. How do you see that playing out in the coming months?
Well, my impression is that she's going to talk about her business experience. In other words, that's her qualification. In the same way that Ron Johnson talked about his business experience and that he knew how to create jobs. And that was a winning theme against Senator Feingold. But I think even though she talks about it a lot, it's more to the point that she's running as a standard-issue Democrat. In other words, she's not running as a conservative Democrat. She's not running as a highly liberal Democrat, just a kind of a no-name Democrat, which is probably a deliberate campaign decision that she's the Democrat with no extra negatives. And how do people feel about Scott Walker versus her?
Let's go to our phone lines now. We have Toby joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Toby.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. The reason I'm calling today, I just think that what we're seeing is, you know, bold ideas is great, and we need more detail from Mary Burke on that. But we've seen bold ideas already from Walker. The problem is he doesn't want to have those ideas judged based on the success of what they're actually accomplishing. He doesn't want to talk about the 250,000 jobs promise, you know, as far as what he's actually done, because he did big things when he first came into office, and they just weren't successful in the way that we were promised. And I think he's judging he wants to be judged based on how things that he's done play with, you know, primary audiences in Iowa and New Hampshire rather than what they're actually doing for Wisconsin.
Okay, thanks a lot, Toby. And Mordecai, what do you think?
I think Toby sort of hit it on the head in the sense of, will this election be a referendum on his incumbency? In other words, it's a kind of a backward-looking report card. You pass, you didn't pass. Or will it be a forward-looking perspective on who will do a better job in the future? If Toby's perspective is right, in other words, you promised 250,000 jobs, you didn't reach it, therefore I'm voting, you know, fill in the blank. I'm voting for you because you're trying. I'm voting against you because you didn't accomplish it. If this is a referendum on the 250,000 jobs, then Mary Burke is advantaged by that.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for your thoughts, Toby. And we'll move on to Nick joining us in Greenfield. Hey, Nick.
Yeah, good afternoon. And thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I hope you can hear me all right, because I got a speakerphone. Your guest mentioned about the campaigning on ideas. And my comment is that Governor Walker campaigned and kept his idea about what he was going to do to the unions. He kept that a secret that was practically never mentioned during his entire campaign. And so my thinking of looking back at Walker is, what sneaky thing has he got up his sleeve next if he does get reelected, and that he's going to spring on us, as he said in his own words, drop the bomb. So what bomb has he got up his sleeve this time?
Okay, Nick, thank you for calling in. And, you know, is there going to be a sense, as Nick has expressed, that maybe Scott Walker is not going to be upfront with all the policies that he wants to pass?
Well, that's generally speaking the narrative against him. And I think when we look at the recall election for the governor's race, that was a referendum about Act 10, whether it was Nick's perspective, why didn't you tell us about this before you were elected, or whether it's a slightly different perspective, I just don't like Act 10. And certainly he survived the recall, and there was a thin layer of voters in the recall election who said that, Well, they didn't necessarily agree with Act 10, but they just didn't feel he deserved to be recalled for that issue. And so that layer of voters is a little bit in play. How will they fall, you know, in November? Will they now say, because of Act 10, I'm not going to vote for Walker? Or Act 10 wasn't that bad, I'm voting for him? Again, it's a battle of ideas, which I think is terrific.
Now, it's possible that Scott Walker, as we're hearing so much speculation about, has bigger things on his mind than the governor's race, that he may be a candidate for president come 2016. How will that, do you think, affect the governor's race, and what are some of the different scenarios that could play out there?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that he'd like to run. I mean, he issued a book. He's making appearances in New Hampshire and Iowa. And I say more power to him in the sense of that it's good to have candidates from Wisconsin on the national scene. Some people like him. Some people don't like him. If he's successful, that'll bring attention to Wisconsin. And also, we have to understand that if he wants to be a successful candidate for president, then he has to be a successful governor first. In other words, he has to do well. And I think we'd want that of any politician, Democrat or Republican, that they'd be so ambitious that they want to do very well by the voters of Wisconsin.
Mordecai, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Veronica.
We've been talking to Mordecai Lee, professor of governmental affairs at UW-Milwaukee, to talk about the new jobs plan Mary Burke unveiled today and the response from Governor Walker.
The deadline to sign up for health insurance through healthcare.gov is less than a week away. Next Monday, the 31st, is the last day to sign up in 2014.
According to a Fox 11 report out yesterday, there are about 500,000 uninsured people in Wisconsin, and only 75,000 of them have signed up for healthcare through the exchanges to date.
Today in our Teach Me What You Know segment, we're going to learn how to sign up for insurance through healthcare.gov. Each week during this segment, we spend about 10-15 minutes learning how to do something new. Nonpartisan Consumer Reports set up a website to help navigate the process. It's called healthlawhelper.org. Nancy Metcalf, senior editor and healthcare expert at Consumer Reports, joins us to share some guidance. Nancy, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Well, the deadline is coming up quick, March 31st, the end of the month, to sign up for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. What happens if you need to sign up by then but don't?
If you don't have insurance, by March 31st, or a completed application for insurance, you can't get insurance again until 2015. That means that if you come down with appendicitis in August and have to have your appendix out, the hospital is going to send you a bill for $30,000. How are you going to pay that?
Mm.
You're not going to have a way to.
And if someone already has insurance and they're not about to lose it, they're not worried about this deadline, right? It's just people who currently don't have insurance.
Yes, if you already have insurance, if you have insurance through a job, if you have Medicare, if you have Medicaid, you're all set. You don't have to do anything. It's people who don't have insurance or people who have there are a few people left who have plans that are sort of holdovers from last year, which were supposed to be eliminated but haven't been. And, in fact, the government recently announced that if you have those plans, you can keep them for another couple of years. But I would encourage people who have those plans to check, go on our online tool, healthlawhelper.org, or go on to the health marketplace, healthcare.gov, and check to see whether you can do better, because you may be able to. There's lots of financial help available for moderate and low-income households to buy health insurance.
Well, speaking of healthcare.gov, of course, a lot of the news when that first rolled out was that it was not working at all or not very well. Where is that today? How glitchy is it now?
Not glitchy at all. It's working extremely well. It's not that it's perfect for everybody, but I would say the chances are extremely high if you go on there that you can get through the process without any trouble. It's night and day different than it was last fall.
One of our producers went on just a little while ago and found himself in a virtual waiting room. He was asked to gather his information and stand by. Is that still happening pretty often?
Well, it happens sometimes. And since we're kind of at the very, very last days of the process now, it's likely to happen because there's a lot of procrastinators out there, and you're just going to have to be brave and get yourself through it.
And as always, the site is often clogged by journalists, I think. Well, assuming you get through that virtual waiting room, about how long does it take to sign up for healthcare?
You know, it's kind of like doing your income taxes. In fact, it's exactly like doing your income taxes because the financial help that's available through the marketplace is completely based on your taxable income, your modified adjusted gross income, it's called. So you're going to be asked for the same kinds of financial information that you use to prepare your tax return. Since it's tax season anyway, you probably have that to hand. Have it out and ready because you're going to need it to apply for health insurance. What you don't need anymore is any information about your health history. They don't care. Everybody gets to buy health insurance, no pre-existing condition exclusions anymore.
So if I've got everything I did to prepare taxes, that's all the info I'm going to need pretty much?
It's entirely about income now, yes.
And that's those are the kind of questions you'll answer on the site? Or what? Walk us through the procedure. What questions do they ask? What do we fill out there?
Well, what you're going to be asked, one thing you're going to be asked is whether you have any insurance now, because if you have Medicare or if you have insurance through a job, you're not going to be able to get financial help to buy insurance on the marketplace. What this marketplace is designed for is people who are buying insurance on their own, don't have access to Medicare because they're not old enough or don't have access to job-based insurance, either because their employer doesn't offer it, they work part-time, or they're self-employed. And they don't have anybody to buy it for them except themselves. These are the people for whom the marketplace is designed, and these are the people that the marketplace is going to ask additional questions about income.
At Consumer Reports, you've put up a website to help guide us through the process. How does that work? What do we get from going on that website?
Well, again, it's healthlawhelper.org. We did it because we've found that a lot of people still really don't understand how the law works. What they've kind of tuned it out, I think, maybe because there's been so many political arguments about it. Of course, we're not political. What we're interested in is for consumers who don't have health insurance or don't have affordable health insurance to get what they're now entitled to. So you go on there, you enter very basic information about what you expect your income to be in 2014, how many people live in your household, where you live, how old you are, and it will tell you what kinds of help you may be eligible for. It can be different from state to state, depending on whether the state is expanding Medicaid or not. There's a children's Medicaid called CHIP, different income levels for that, but Health Law Helper knows all that. And so they will tell you what your household may be eligible for, and then they will send you off to wherever you need to go to access that.
We're going to post that website on the Central Time Facebook page, by the way. One thing very comforting when I went to look at it, it said something like 51% of people are confused about the impact of the health care law. I think anybody who feels confused will be happy to know they're not alone there.
They are certainly not alone.
Once we are through the Consumer Reports site and we're on the healthcare exchange, we've got some shopping to do and some decisions to make. How do we choose what healthcare plan we want?
You know, one of the big misconceptions I hear from consumers is, do I have to buy the government plan? Well, if you're purchasing insurance through the health marketplace, you're not going to be able to buy a government plan because there aren't any. All of the plans for sale on the marketplaces are private insurance plans from insurance companies you've probably already heard of, Blue Cross, you know, United Healthcare, Oxford, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So your big decision is going to be which one to pick. You're going to have some choices. It's important to note that every single plan for sale on these marketplaces is good insurance in that there is no upper limit on what they will cover. You know, if you need an organ transplant, it costs $2 million, they'll pay for it. And it covers all kinds of medical care. Anything that a person would need throughout the course of their life, maternity care, mental health care, rehab, doctors, hospitals, drugs, you know, pediatrics, preventive care, the whole gamut, ambulances, everything, emergency care. So you don't have to worry, as you did in the old days, about accidentally ending up with a plan that didn't cover stuff.
But there are deductibles
and not finding out until it's too late.
There are deductibles and copays to figure out, right?
There are deductibles and copays. You're going to find three levels of plans, bronze, silver, and gold. Again, they all cover the same stuff. The difference is the bronze plans have lower premiums, but you're going to be paying more out of pocket when you access the care. Silver plans, kind of in the middle. Gold plans, higher premiums but lower out of pocket, meaning lower deductibles, lower copays, and so on. No matter which plan you get, the most you will ever have to pay out of pocket for health care in a year is $6,350, which is your kind of catastrophic upper limit if something horrible should happen. Most people wouldn't ever come near that, but that's your upper limit. So if you end up needing, you know, having some catastrophe, cancer treatment or some terrible accident and you have a six-figure medical bill, you're going to be paying very little of it.
There are some subsidies to help pay the premiums out there. How do we figure out if we're eligible and how much we get?
Well, our tool, healthlawhelper.org, will tell you whether you're eligible. To find out exactly how much you're entitled to, you need to go to healthcare.gov and go through the process. And at the end of that, you will be told what your subsidy is. It's based on your income, your age. It's a formula. And then once you know what the subsidy is, you'll be told start shopping for plans. And then you can pick out whichever plan you want and apply your subsidy to that. And the subsidy works in a very helpful way. You can use it month to month. So say you get a subsidy for $100 a month. You pick out a plan with a $350 a month premium. You're only going to have to pay $250 of it up front. Every month, the government will send the insurance company a check for its share of the cost. So it's very helpful. And these subsidies go up to pretty high income levels. A family of five can get a subsidy with an income of up to $110,000 a year. A couple can get a subsidy with an income of up to $63,000 a year. So I think people are surprised. About 80% of the people purchasing insurance on healthcare.gov are getting these subsidies.
As you mentioned, if we don't sign up by the deadline, we're waiting till 2015. If we do sign up by the deadline, when does coverage kick in?
Well, since it's towards the end of the sign-up period, it's probably not going to kick in until April 1st. But as long as you enroll by the end of March, you won't be fined for not having insurance in 2014.
And if someone out there knows they need to sign up, they feel daunted, overwhelmed by the process, can you leave us with some advice for them?
There are places to get help. There's an 800 number that you can call. Because there's probably a last-minute rush, there's going to be some waits for those calls. There are also local helpers in every area who can walk you through the process personally. To find those, you want to go to localhelp.com/healthcare.gov, put in where you live, and you'll get a list of places that you can call.
Nancy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Nancy Metcalf, senior editor and healthcare expert at Consumer Reports. The last day to sign up for health insurance through healthcare.gov is Monday, March 31st.
The website that Nancy Metcalf mentioned that will help you navigate the enrollment process is healthlawhelper.org, and there's a link at the Central Time Facebook page.